Audible Frontiers presents The Claw of the Conciliator, written by Gene Wolfe and narrated by Jonathan Davis.
Chapter 17. The Tale of the Student and His Son. Part 1. The Redoubt of the Magicians. Once upon the margin of the unpastured sea, there stood a city of pale towers. In it dwelt the wise. Now that city had both law and curse. The law was this: that for all who dwelt there, life held but two paths. They might rise among the wise and walk clad with hoods of myriad colors, or they must leave the city and go into the friendless world. Now one there was who had studied long all the magic known in the city, which was most of the magic known in the world. And he grew near the time at which he must choose his path. In high summer, when flowers with yellow and careless heads thrust even from the dark walls overlooking the sea, he went to one of the wise, who had shaded his face with myriad colors for longer than most could remember, and for long had taught the student whose time was come. And he said to him, "How may I, even I who know nothing, have a place among the wise of the city? For I wish to study spells that are not sacred all my days, and not go into the friendless world to dig and carry for bread." Then the old man laughed and said, "Do you recall how, when you were hardly more than a boy, I taught you the art by which we flesh suns from dream stuff? How skillful you were in those days, surpassing all the others. Go now and flesh such a sun, and I will show it to the hooded ones, and you will be as we." But the student said, "Another season. Let pass another season, and I will do everything you advise." Autumn came, and the sycamores of the city of pale towers, that were sheltered from the sea winds by its high wall, dropped leaves like the gold manufactured by their owners. And the wild salt geese streamed among the pale towers, and after them the ossifrage and the lammergeier. Then the old man sent again for him who had been his student, and said, "Now, surely, you must flesh for yourself a creation of dream as I have instructed you. For the others among the hooded ones grow impatient. Save for us, you are the eldest in the city. And it may be that if you do not act now, they will turn you out by winter." But the student answered, "I must study further, that I may achieve what I seek. Can you not for one season protect me?" And the old man, who had taught him, thought of the beauty of the trees that had for so many years delighted his eyes like the white limbs of women. At length the golden autumn wore away, and winter came stalking into the land from his frozen capital, where the sun rolls along the edge of the world like a trumpery gilded ball, and the fires that flow between the stars and earth kindle the sky. His touch turned the waves to steel, and the city of the magicians welcomed him, hanging banners of ice from its balconies and heaping its roofs with glaces of snow. The old man summoned his student again, and the student answered as before. Spring came, and with it gladness to all nature. But at spring the city was hung with black, and hatred, and the loathing of one's own powers, that eats like a worm at the heart, fell on the magicians. For the city had but one law and one curse. And though the law held sway all the year, the curse ruled the spring. In spring, the most beautiful maidens of the city, the daughters of the magicians, were clothed in green, and while the soft winds of spring teased their golden hair, they walked unshod through the portal of the city, and down the narrow path that led to the quay, and boarded the black-sailed ship that waited them. And because of their golden hair and their gowns of green file, and because it seemed to the magicians that they were reaped like grain, they were called Corn Maidens. When the man who had long been the student of the old man, but was yet unhooded, heard the dirges and laments, and looking from his window saw the maidens filing by, he set aside all his books and began to draw such figures as no man had ever seen, and to write in many languages, as his master had taught him aforetime. Part 2. The Fleshing of the Hero. Day after day he labored. When the first light came at the window, his pen had been a drudge already many hours. And when the moon tangled her crooked back among the pale towers, his lamp shone bright. At first it seemed to him that all the skill his master had taught him of old had deserted him, for from the first light to the moonlight, he was alone in his chambers, save for the moth that fluttered sometimes to show the insignia of death at his undaunted candle flame. Then there crept into his dreams, when sometimes he nodded over the table another. And he, knowing who that other was, welcomed him, though the dreams were fleeting and soon forgotten. He labored on, and that which he strove to create gathered about him as smoke collects about the new fuel thrown upon a fire almost dead. At times, and particularly when he worked early or late, and when having at long last laid aside all the implements of his art, he stretched himself at length upon the narrow bed provided for those who had not yet earned the many-colored hood. He heard the step, always in another room, of the man he hoped to call into life. In time, these manifestations, originally rare, and indeed at first limited, almost entirely to those nights when thunder rumbled among the pale towers, became common, and there were unmistakable signs of the other's presence. A book he had not unshelved in decades lying beside a chair. Windows and doors that unlocked, as it seemed, of themselves. An ancient alphonse, for years past an ornament hardly more deadly than a trompe l'oeil picture, found cleansed of its patina, gleaming and newly sharp. One golden afternoon, when the wind played the innocent games of childhood with the fresh-fledged sycamores, there came a knock at the door of his study. Not daring to turn or express even the smallest part of what he felt by his voice, or even to desist from his work, he called, "Enter." As doors open at midnight, though no living thing stirs, the door began, a thread's width at a time, to swing back. Yet as it moved, it seemed to gather strength, so that when it was open, as he judged by the sound, enough that a hand might have been thrust into the room, it seemed that the playful breeze had come in by the window to push life into its wooden heart. And when it was open, as he judged again, wider still, so much so that a diffident helot might have entered with a tray, it seemed a very sea-storm seized it and flung it back against the wall. Then he heard strides behind him, quick and resolute, and a voice respectful and youthful, yet deep with a cleanly manhood, addressed him, saying, "Father, I little like to vex you when you are deep in your art, but my heart is sorely troubled, and has been so these several days, and I beg you by the love you have for me to suffer my intrusion and counsel me in my difficulties." Then the student dared turn himself where he sat, and he saw standing before him a youth haughty of port, wide of shoulder, and mighty of thew. Command was in his firm mouth, knowing wit in his bright eyes, and courage in all his face. Upon his brow sat that crown that is invisible to every eye, but can be seen even by the blind. The crown beyond price that draws brave men to a paladin, and makes weak men brave. Then the student said, "My son, have no fear of disturbing me, now or ever, for there is nothing under heaven that I should rather see than your face. What is it that troubles you? Father, the young man said, every night for many nights my sleep has been rent with the screams of women, and often I have seen, like a green serpent called by the notes of a pipe, a column of green slip down the cliff below our city to the quay. And sometimes it is vouchsafed me in my dream to go near. And then I see that all who walk in that column are fair women, and that they weep and scream and stagger as they walk, so that I might think them a field of young grain beaten by a moaning wind. What is the meaning of this dream? My son, said the student, the time has come when I must tell you what I have concealed from you until now, fearing that in the rashness of your youth you might dare too much before the time was ripe. Know that this city is oppressed by an ogre, who each year demands of it its fairest daughters, even as you have seen in your dream. At this the young man's eyes flashed, and he demanded, who is this ogre, and what form has he, and where does he dwell? His name no man knows, for no man can approach near enough. His form is that of a navishkaput, which is to say that to men he appears a ship, having upon its deck, which is in truth his shoulders, a single castle, which is his head, and in the castle, a single eye. But his body swims in the deep waters with the skate and the shark, with arms longer than the most lofty masts, and legs like pilings that reach even to the floor of the sea. His harbor is an isle to the west, where a channel with many a twist and bend, dividing and redividing, reaches far inland. It is on this isle, so my lore teaches me, that the corn maidens are made to dwell. And there he rides at anchor in the midst of them, turning his eye ever to left and right, to watch them in their despair. Part 3. The Encounter with the Princess. Then the young man fared forth, and gathered to him other young men of the city of the magicians to be his crew, and from those who wore the colored hoods he obtained a stout ship. And all that summer he and the young men he had gathered to him armored her, and mounted on her sides the mightiest artillery, and 100 times practiced the making of sail, and the reefing of sail, and the firing of the guns, until she answered as a blooded mare does to the rein. For the pity they felt for the corn maidens, they christened her Land of Virgins. At last, when the golden leaves fell from the sycamores, even as the gold, manufactured by magicians, falls at last from the hands of men, and the gray salt geese streamed among the pale towers of the city, with the lammergeier and the ossifrage screaming at them, the youth set sail. Much befell them on the whale road to the Isle of the Ogre, that has no place here. But at the end of those adventures, the lookout saw before them a country of tawny hills dotted with green. And even as they shaded their eyes to see it, the green grew greater and greater still. Then the young man, whom the student had fleshed from dreams, knew that it was indeed the Isle of the Ogre, and that the corn maidens were hastening to the shore for the sight of his sail. Then were the great guns readied, and the flags of the city of the magicians, that are all of yellow and black, were hung in the rigging. Near they came and nearer, until fearing to run aground, they put about and beat along the coast. The corn maidens followed them, and following attracted more of their sisterhood, until they covered all the land like grain indeed. But the young man did not forget what he had been told, that the ogre lived among the corn maidens. After a half-day sailing, they rounded a point and saw that the coast fell away as a deep channel that did not end, but wound its way among the low hills of the country until it was lost to sight. At the entrance to this channel stood a colossus of white marble surrounded by gardens, and here The young man ordered his companions to cast anchor and went ashore. He had no more than set foot on the soil of the isle than there came to meet him a woman of great beauty, swart of skin, black of hair, and luminous of eye. He bowed before her, saying, "Princess or queen, I see that you are not of the Corn Maidens. Their robes are green, yours is sable. Yet were you to wear a dress of green, I should know you still, for your eyes sorrow not, and the light that is in them is not of earth."
"You speak truly," the princess said, "for I am Nochua, the daughter of the night, and the daughter too of him whom you have come to slay."
"Then we cannot be friends, Nochua," said the young man, "but let us not be enemies." For though he did not know why, being of the stuff of dreams, he was drawn to her, and she, whose eyes held starlight, to him. At this the princess spread her hands and declared,
"Know that my father took my mother by force, and here holds me against my wishes, where I would soon go mad, were it not that she comes to me at each day's end. If you do not see sorrow in my eyes, it is only because it lies upon my heart. That I may be free, I shall willingly counsel you how you may engage my father and triumph."
All the young men of the city of the magicians grew quiet and gathered to listen to her.
"First, you must understand that the waterways of this isle turn and turn again, in such a way that they can never be charted. You can by no means use sail as you wander them, but must kindle your furnaces ere you go farther."
"I have no fear of that," said the young man, flushed from dreams. "Half a forest was laid waste to fill our bins, and those great wheels you see shall walk these waters with the tread of giants." At that the princess trembled and said,
"Oh, speak not of giants, for you know not what you say. Many ships have come as you have, until the oozy bottoms of all these measureless channels are white with skulls. For it is the custom of my father to allow them to wander among the islets and straits until their fuel is spent, however much it may be, and then, coming upon them by night, when he can see them by the glow of their dying fires, and they not see him, slay them."
Then the heart of the young man, fleshed from dreams, was troubled, and he said,
"We will seek him as we are sworn. But is there no way in which we may escape the fate of those others?"
At this, the princess took pity on him, for all who have the stuff of dreams about them seem fair in some degree, at least to the daughters of night, and he, fairest of all. Thus she said,
"To find my father before your last stick is burned, you need only search out the darkest water. For wherever he passes, his great body raises a foul mud, and by observing it, you may discover him. But each day you must begin the search at dawn, and at noon desist, for otherwise you may come upon him by twilight, and it will go evilly with you."
"For this counsel, I would have given my life," said the young man. And all his companions who had come ashore with him raised a cheer.
"For now, we will surely overcome the ogre."
At this, the solemn face of the princess became more sober yet, and she said,
"No, not surely, for he is a dread antagonist in any sea fight. But I know a stratagem that may aid you. You have said that you came well supplied. Have you tar to pay your ship, should she leak?"
"Many barrels," said the young man.
"Then when you fight, see that the wind blows from yourself to him, and when the fight is hottest,
which will not be long after you have joined, have your men cast tar into your furnaces. I cannot promise that it will give you the victory, but it will aid you greatly." At this, all the young men thanked her most extravagantly, and the corn maidens, who had stood shyly by while the young man fleshed from dreams and the daughter of night spoke, raised such a cheer as maidens raise, a cheer not strong but filled with joy. Then the young men made ready to depart, kindling the fires in the great furnaces amidships, until the white specter was born that drives good ships ahead, no matter what wind may blow. And the princess watched them from the strand and gave them her blessing. But just as the great wheels began to turn, so slowly at first that they appeared scarcely to move, she called the young man fleshed from dreams to the railing, saying, "It may be that you shall find my father. Should you find him, it may be that you shall defeat him, laying low even such prowess as his. Yet even so, you may be sorely vexed to find your way to the sea once more, for the channels of this isle are most wondrously wrought. Yet there is a way. From my father's right hand, you must flay the tip of the first finger. There, you will see 1,000 tangled lines. Be not discouraged, but study it closely, for it is the map he followed in webbing the waterways, that he himself might always have it by him." Part 4. The Battle with the Ogre. Inland they turned their bow, and even as the princess had foretold, the channel they followed soon divided, and divided again, until there were 1,000 forking channels and 10,000 islets. When the shadow of the mainmast was no larger than a hat, the young man fleshed from dreams gave orders that the anchors be cast, and the fires banked, and there, for a long afternoon, they waited, oiling the guns and readying the powder, and preparing all that might be needful in the hardest fought battle. At length, night came, and they saw her striding from islet to islet with her bats about her shoulders and her direwolves dogging her steps. No more than an easy carronade shot from their anchorage she seemed, yet they all observed that she passed not before Hesperus and even Sirius, but they before her. For a moment only she turned her face toward them, and none could be certain what her look conveyed. But all of them wondered if indeed the ogre had taken her without her will, as her daughter had said, and if so, if she had not lost the resentment she might be imagined to have felt. With the first light, the trumpet sounded from the quarterdeck, and the banked fires were fed new fuel. But as the dawn breeze stood fair for the channel they held, the young man ordered all plain sail set before the great wheels were ready to take their first step. And when the white specter wakened, the ship pressed forward at double speed. For many leagues that channel ran, not straight, but near enough that there was no need to furl the sails or even put about. 100 others crossed it, and at each they studied the water, but each was translucent as crystal. To tell the strange sights they beheld on the islets they passed would require 12 tales as long as this. Women, stem-grown like flowers, overhung the ship, and in kissing them, sought to smear their faces with the powder from their cheeks. Men to whom wine had brought death long before lay by springs of wine and drank still, too stupefied to know their lives were past. Beasts that would be omens to future times, with twisted limbs and fur of colors never seen, waited the nearer approach of battles, earthquakes, and the murders of kings. At last, the youth who stood first mate to the young man fleshed from dreams approached him where he waited near the steersman, saying, "Far we have traveled on this channel already, and the sun, that had not shown his face when we bent our sails, approaches his zenith. Following it, we have crossed 1,000 others, and none has shown a trace of the ogre. May it not be that it is an unlucky course we take? Would it not be wiser to turn aside soon and try another? Then the young man answered, Even now we pass a channel to starboard. Look down and tell me if its waters are more soiled than our own. The youth did as he was bid and said, Nay, clearer. Soon now. Another opens to port. To what depth can you see? The youth waited until the ship stood opposite the channel of which the young man spoke, and then he answered, To the utmost. I see the wreck of a ship of long time past, many a fathom down. And can you see so far in this channel we sail now? Then the youth looked at the waters they cleaved, and they were become as ink, and the very splatters that flew from the laboring wheels might have been rooks and ravens. At once understanding came to him, and he shouted to all the others to stand by the guns, for he could not tell them to make ready, who had made ready so long before. Ahead lay an islet higher than most, crowned with tall and somber trees, and here the channel bent gently, so that the wind that had been dead astern was at the quarter. The steersman shifted his grip on the wheel, and the watch paid out certain sheets and tightened others, and the ship's prow came around the quick curve of the cliff, and there before them lay a long hull of narrow beam, with a single castle of iron amidships, and a single gun larger than any they carried thrusting from its one embrasure. Then the young man, fleshed from dreams, opened his lips to shout to the bow-chaser crews that they should fire. Before the words could be spoken, the great gun of their enemy roared, and its sound was not as thunder, or as any other sound familiar to the ears of men, but rather it seemed that they had stood in a tall tower of stone, and it had fallen all around them in a moment. And the ball of that shot struck the breech of the first gun of their starboard battery, and striking it broke it to pieces and shattered itself as well, so that the fragments of the breaking of both scattered through the ship like dark leaves before a great wind, and many died thereby. Then the steersman, waiting no order, swung the ship about until her port battery bore, and the guns fired each by the will of the man that pointed it, as wolves howl at the moon. And their shots flew about the single castle of the enemy to either side, and some struck it, so that it tolled knells for those who had perished a moment before, and some struck the water before the hull that bore it, and some struck the deck, which was of iron also, and at that contact fled shrieking into the sky. Then the single gun of their enemy spoke again. And so it continued, in moments that seemed whole years of time. At last, the young man bethought him of the advice of the princess, the daughter of night. And though the wind blew strong, it was hardly more than astern of his ship, and if he were to shift until it blew from him to his enemy, as the princess had counseled, for many moments no gun would bear but the bow chasers, and then, when a battery might be brought to bear, it would be the starboard, of which one gun was destroyed and so many men dead. But it came to him in that moment that they fought as 100 others had fought, and that these 100 others were all dead, their ship sunk, and their bones scattered among the myriad channels that whirled and tangled the face of the Isle of the Ogre. Then he gave his order to the steersman, but none answered, for he was dead, and the wheel he had held him. So seeing, the young man, fleshed from dreams, took the spokes in his own hands and presented to their enemy the ship's narrow bow. Then it was seen how the three sisters favor the bold, for the next shot from their enemy, that might have raked her from stem to stern, went to port by the length of an oar, and the next to starboard by the width of a boat. Now their enemy, who had stood fast before, neither seeking to fly nor to close, swung about. Seeing that he would escape them if he could, the crew raised a great shout as though already they had won the victory. But marvelous to see, the single castle, which all until then believed fixed, swung about the other way, so that its great gun, that was greater than any of their own, still bore. A moment later, and its ball had struck them amidships, dashing a gun of the starboard battery from its truck, as a drunken man might fling an infant from its cradle, and sending it skittering across the deck and smashing everything in its path. Then the guns of the battery, those that remained, spoke all in a chorus of fire and iron. And because the distance was now less than half what it had been, or perhaps only because their enemy, having shown fear, had weakened the fabric of his being, their shot no longer struck his castle with an empty clanging, but with a cracking, as though the bell that will toll the end of the world were breaking, and ragged flaws sprang to life on the oiled blackness of the iron. Then the young man shouted into the Gosport to those who had remained faithfully in the engine room, feeding the furnaces with tree rack, telling them to cast tar into the flames as the princess had counseled them. At first he feared that all there were dead, then that the order was not understood in the din of battle. But a shadow fell upon the sun-brightened water that stretched between their enemy and himself, and he looked upward. In ancient times, so it is said, a tattered child, the daughter of a fisherman, found on the sand a stoppered flask, and by breaking the seal and drawing forth the cork, became queen from ice to ice. Just so, it seemed, an elemental being, strong with the strength of the forging of creation, debouched from the tall smokestacks of their ship, tumbling over himself in dark joy and growing with a rush as the wind comes. And the wind came indeed, and it seized him with its uncounted hands and bore him as a solid mass down upon their enemy. Even when nothing more could be seen, neither the long, dark hull with its deck of iron, nor the single guns whose mouths had spoken words to doom them, they wasted no moment, but fell to their guns and fired into the blackness. And from time to time they heard the gun of their enemy also firing, but no flash did they see, and where those shots struck, they could not say. It may be they have struck nothing yet, and still circle round the world, seeking their target. They fired until the barrels shone like ingots newly come from the crucible. Then the smoke that had poured forth so long diminished, and those below shouted by the Gosport that all the tar was consumed. And the young man fleshed from dreams ordered that firing cease, and the men who had worked the guns fell upon the deck like so many corpses, too exhausted even to beg water. The black cloud melted, not as fog melts in the sun, but as an army strong to evil dissolves before repeated charges, giving here, stubbornly standing there, still mustering a wisp of skirmishers when it seems all has given way. In vain, then, they searched the new polished waves for their enemy. Nothing could they see. Not his hull, nor his castle, nor his gun, nor any plank or spar. Slowly, so cautiously it might have been thought they feared an unseen foe, they advanced to the very spot where he had lain at anchor, noting the shattered trees and furrowed ground of the islet beyond, where their shot had spent its energies. When they were over the point at which that long iron hull had lain, the young man fleshed from dreams ordered the great wheels reversed, and at last halted, so that they rested as quietly as their opponent had. Then he strode to the rail and looked down, but with such an expression that no one, not even the most brave, dared to look at him. When he lifted his eyes at last, his face was set and grim, and with no word to any man, he took himself to his cabin and barred the door. Then the youth that was second to him ordered the ship put about, that they might return to the white calotte of the princess. And he ordered also that wounds be bandaged and pumps set in motion, and such repairs as could be made begun. but the dead he kept with them, that they might be buried on the high sea. Part 5. The Death of the Student. It may be that the channel was not so straight as they believed, or that they had lost their bearings in the fight without being aware thereof, or that the channels twisted, as some alleged, like worms in a lich, when no eye was upon them. Whatever the truth might be, all day they steamed, for the wind had died away, and by the last light saw only that they cruised among islets unknown. All night they lay to. When morning came, the youth called to him such others as he felt might offer the most valuable counsel. But none of them could suggest anything save calling upon the young man fleshed from dreams, which they were loath to do, or pressing onward, until they reached open waters or the Kalat of the princess. That they did all day, striving to hold a straight course, but winding against their will among the many turnings of the channels. And when night came again, their position was no better than before. But on the morning of the third day, the young man fleshed from dreams came out of his cabin and began to walk up and down the decks as he was wont to do, examining such repairs as they had made to their damage, and asking those wounded, who by the pain of their wounds were awake early, how they fared. Then the youth and those who had advised him came to him, and they explained all that they had done and asked how they might find the sea again, that they might bury the dead and return to their homes in the city of the magicians. At this he looked up into the very vault of the firmament, and some thought he prayed, and some that he sought to restrain the anger he felt against them, and some only that he hoped to gain inspiration there. But so long did he stare that they waxed afraid, even as they had when he had peered into the water, and one or two began to creep away. Then he said to them, "Behold, do you not see the sea birds? From every corner of the sky they stream. Follow them." Until morning was nearly done, they followed the birds insofar as the winding channels permitted. And at last they saw them wheeling and diving at the water ahead, so their white wings and ebon heads seemed a cloud low hung in their course, a cloud fair without but thunderous within. Then the young man fleshed from dreams told them to load a carronade with powder only, and to fire it, and at the crash of the gun all those sea birds rose mewing and crying. And where they had been, the crew saw a great piece of carrion floating, which seemed to them to have been a beast of the land, for it had, as they thought, a head and legs four. But it was greater than many elephants. When they were near, the young man ordered the boat put into the water, and when he climbed aboard, they saw that he'd thrust into his belt a great alphonse whose blade caught the sun. For a time, he labored over the carrion, and when he returned, he carried a chart, the largest any of them had seen, drawn upon untanned hide. By dark, they reached the Kalat of the princess. All waited on board while her mother visited her, but when that terrible woman was gone, all who could walk went ashore, and the corn maidens crowded about them, 100 to each youth. And the young man fleshed from dreams took the daughter of night into his arms and led them all in dances. None of them ever forgot that night. The dew found them beneath the trees of the princess's garden, half smothered in flowers. For a time they slept so, but when afternoon threw backward the shadows of their masts, they were awake. Then the princess bade farewell to the isle and swore that, though she might visit every country over which her mother strode, she never would return there. And the corn maidens swore likewise. Too many of them there were, perhaps, for the ship to hold, yet it held them, so that all the decks were green with their gowns and gold with their hair. Many adventures they had in making their way back to the city of the magicians. This tale might tell how they cast their dead into the sea with prayers. Yet afterward, saw them in the rigging by night. Or how certain of the corn maidens wed those princes who, having spent years so long enchanted that they are loath to leave that life, and have in that time learned much of the grammary, build palaces on lily pads, and are seldom seen by men. But all those things have no place here. Be it sufficient to say that as they neared the cliff, at whose top stands the city of the magicians, the student who had fleshed the young man from dreams stood on the battlements, watching for them over the sea. And when he beheld their dark sails, smutted by the burning tar that had blinded their enemy, he believed them blackened in mourning for the young man, and he threw himself down, and so perished. For no man lives long when his dreams are dead.